Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I can see that preaching a sermon on salvation may have caused the rapture for some of our fellow members. But I'm going to persevere, try to grapple with this term and understanding. And I was thinking about the title, Salvation, Rescue, Liberty, Freedom, Emancipation, Freedom of Conscience. Are these concepts about the same aspects of the human struggle? And I suspect there are some that would say, how in the world can, as we understand salvation, can you put salvation and liberty in the same sentence when liberty is about, in our culture today, liberal movement, progressive movement, and civil liberties, and the communities that, I was going to say yell about salvation, that's not right, preach about salvation, teach about salvation, and some of our minds are just the opposite of liberty, and how in the world can they be put into the same frame? And then on the other hand, when we read William Ellery Channing's The Free Mind, the question comes to us. First of all, why write something called The Free Mind? Why even have it? And why does he say that we need to guard our free mind? We need to guard our mind. What is he doing? This is what, 1810 when he wrote this? We need to call that mind free that's not passively framed. Well, he wouldn't make that statement unless minds were being passively framed. Or he would not even move in that direction. I call that mind free which protects itself from teachings and conformity to society at large. Well, he wouldn't have to address that unless there were pressures to conform the nature of our minds and the structure of our imagination. I call that mind free which resists bondage of habits. Well, then that must mean we're vulnerable to bondage of habits. I call that mind free which sets no bounds to its love. Well, what he's telling us is we are vulnerable to set bonds and boundaries to our love toward one another in our culture. He's calling our attention to the vulnerability of our minds to be captured, to be captivated, to be conformed, and to, in a way, passively accept our captivity as the normal way of life. William Ellery Channing, the founder of Unitarian Universalism in our nation. I was thinking about how do we talk about this? It's almost like a fish in toxic water. But it lives. It doesn't die. It lives. But the water is still toxic and it doesn't affect the fish. And so you go into the water and you want to tell the fish, you want to say, this water's toxic. You need to move it. And the fish looks at you and says, what are you talking about? I've been surrounded here. Everything's been fine. The fish has no consciousness of what's not toxic water because it's never been there. And so when somebody says to me, Gregory, you need to be freed from the captivity of the culture that has captured your mind, I'm going, well, what are you talking about? I am free. I do what I want. I pretty much go where I want. And that's my initial response. You know, of course, I get older and I said, well, how free am I? If I stop working, they'll take the house. Even if you own the house, you don't have to, you got to pay taxes on the house. Right. So really, how free are we? We're not, because what that means is I have to behave in a particular way to make a certain amount of money to pay the taxes, and there are certain jobs available, certain things available for me to do that, and the things I like to do are not available for me to do, so I have to do something I don't want to do in order not to lose my home, and back and forth and back and forth, and then I'm trapped with credit cards and interest rates, and so my behavior has to be a particular way to pay that, and I've been paying year after year after year after
year, and I'm still no better off on the principle than when I first started 4 years ago, and I'm captured, and so I can't change my behavior. I can't go on the vacations I want to go to. I can't visit what I want to do, because if I do, my boss will tell me I lose my job. But I'm free. I live in the land of freedom. Are we free? Do we need to be, that horrible word, saved? I'm going to define. I tell you, get up here. You can do grandiose things from this position. You might not return, but I can do these grandiose things. So I'm going to define salvation from, I think, an acceptable position from Unitarian Universalism. And I'm going to define salvation as this: a moment when the heart absorbs the mind. A moment when all of your thinking, a moment when all of your anxieties, a moment when all of your memories, a moment when all of your ponderings about your future, a moment when all of the things that you worry about that hold you captive, a moment when all of those things are absorbed into your heart, and the outcome is a sense of being love. I'm going to define that as salvation. When we began this conversation about religious terms, and particularly Christianity, we began with the title of An Atheist Defends the Need, talks about the need for the Christian story and the Christian myth, and how important it was for this atheist to talk about that in terms of actually liberating our culture from captivity of for him, the ruling class. And so I began taking that notion: if you take religious terms, how do you take religious terms and define them without the notion of other than what is human? So how would we define salvation, not in terms that there is a God going to save us and extract us one day from here to this other place, heaven? So how would you define salvation without that? I'm not saying that exists or doesn't exist. That's not part of this conversation. But how would you define salvation in terms of what it means to be human? And so when we look at the definition of salvation as an aspect of your mind being absorbed into your heart, and the outcome is being the sense of love, being at peace, being calm, and not having this external world, as I described before, that forces our behavior into a particular fashion and form so I can be here, so that I can belong here, but to be free of that, to let that go, to know yourself as other than what this external world says about you. Salvation. Of course, in that same thinking, it's really Sufi thought. Sufi spirituality and Christian mystical spirituality would define our experience that way. There's you also find this statement, which is a little harder: the mind must be hammered into the heart. So it sounds nice that the mind, and you let your cares go and you let your beliefs go and your thoughts go, and you're absorbed into your heart, and you experience this wonderful experience of love, and then when you come out of that experience, you feel more compassion for yourself and for others, and that's a wonderful thing and a wonderful experience. And it sounds easy. Sounds like when we were recently in Vermont and listening to the brooks and the streams, and what a wonderful sound. But then you go down another paragraph later, and it says, well, the mind must be hammered into the heart.
And I'm saying, that doesn't sound as sweet as that as that other. Wonder why
they said that. And then I remember in my clinical training, which was a number of years, more than I care to think about at this moment, 7, 8, 9 years. And especially in the beginning, one of the things that was repeated to me, and not just to me, but to many of us, is that you're in your head all the time. Where's your heart? Can you speak from your heart? You're into your head. You've got to get your head and heart, together. And you know, and so we begin to wrestle with that. And then I began to listen. I began to hear stories, especially with talking to people and with talking to couples. And when you talk to couples, invariably you hear one that this person has all these rationales, these arguments, but I don't know who they are. I don't know how they feel. I don't know where their heart is. I don't know how they think, how they feel, who they are. I know how they think, but I don't know how they feel. And how many times have I asked somebody, and somebody asked me, well, how do you feel about that? And you know, the classical question you sometimes see on comedies about therapy and kind of thing. Well, how do you feel about that? Well, the reason why that's such a powerful thing is because often we don't know how we feel about something. I used to do this meditative exercise, and invite you to consider something like this for your own spiritual journey. Because of the incongruency of how I perceived myself and my feelings, and in some ways how I truly was at a particular point in time, recognizing there's something to that. I might say I'm one way, but after talking with somebody, I discover that actually I'm another way. I actually feel different about that. So I created this exercise where I would say, yeah, this is how I feel about this particular topic, this particular person, or where I'm at in my life now, or for something. And then I'd slow the world down, and I'd watch myself walk down a path, sit by a river, and ask myself, now, how do you really feel about that? Often, the two answers were different. So when we hear the words that salvation or relief or liberty from the captivity and conformity of this world is when the heart absorbs the mind, that's no easy path. That's a difficult path. It's not an easy path. A help on that path by the poet Rumi, he writes this: make everything in you an ear, every atom of your being, and you will hear at every moment what the source is whispering to you, just to you and for you. Without any need for my words or anyone else's, you are, we all are, the beloved of the beloved. And in every moment and in every event of your life, the beloved is whispering to you exactly what you need to hear and know. Who can ever explain this miracle? It simply is. Listen, and you will discover it at every passing moment. Listen, and your whole life will become a conversation in thought and act between you and her, directly, wordlessly, now, and always.
Now, some of us may say, that sounds nice, but what this person is saying, that's an anthropological statement. What this person is saying, if you follow this spiritual path, this will be your experience. This will be what you will know is that there is a voice within you that will speak to you and give you the words you need to hear at any given moment. If we stop and slow down and make ourselves this ear.
However, we live in this world in which William Ellery Channing writes this piece, you have to protect yourself from these things, from this conformity, from this world collapsing in on you. You have to protect yourself, and one way to protect ourselves is to create a space in which we can breathe, in which we can be quiet, in which we can hear that voice. But we have to be intentional about creating that space. And we live in a particular difficult time for creating that space. For one, I can't shut my mind off long enough to even think about creating a space because my mind just races and races and races. It just moves and moves and moves. And I thought I'd just give some examples that might not be so obvious about what intrudes upon us that occupies our minds. I mean, sometimes when Helen and I'll do a seminar on something, calming anger and resentment or something like that, and invariably I ask the question, how many of us still have arguments with our parents as we're driving down the interstate when our parents live 400 miles away? You know, how many of us have arguments with people who are not in the car in our heads? How many? I mean, so these things occupy our minds. They're in our minds, and that's part of being conformed to this world and allowing our senses and our emotions to take over our minds. And there are other things that also, and I got to think about, and especially in this day and age when we're talking about passing regulation in the government level, so we talk about our inner worlds and our external world, and as the best I can make, the purpose of regulations, they are to create boundaries, and within these boundaries, we are to behave in a more civilized and caring way, and that's why regulations exist. Some people would say regulations are an intrusiveness, or some people might say, no, regulations help us create the space that we're talking about. So we have regulations that go along with Medicare, and Medicare is important to all of us. And so I read in the paper that there was a scheme by doctors and citizens stealing $251 million from Medicare, nine doctors, 94 people. That's an intrusion into our space. That's an intrusion. As a people, we try to create a government that helps us create a space in order to be in peacefully, and yet here's this intrusion of theft. That's an intrusion in our space. Or that with our medical system, 45,000 people die a year. We read that. Even to the point where, I don't know if you know about Meatless Monday. You ever hear that statement, Meatless Monday? Right. Well, there was a school in Baltimore that said, we're going to do Meatless Monday and we're going to teach our kids about vegetables and about not having such a big carbon footprint in our thing. And we'll be able to talk about all these good things about Meatless Monday and all the reasons why we do it in the body and all this thing. And so to me, thinking of the same thing about clearing a space for conversation, dialogue, and peace, and education, where we can breathe and reflect and try to understand our world and what's going on with us. That was that. And then the next thing you know, here comes this letter from the CEO of Public Relations of Meat Companies of America saying, we are disappointed that you are agreeing with the animal rights groups and preventing your children from eating meat on Monday. And put pressure on them not to do it. So there's intrusiveness that comes to us in today's context from many different directions. So that's the obvious stuff. Right? We clear out of space, we read the news, gets in our brains,
and we have arguments with the news. How many of us yell at TV or yell at politicians on TV and do these things? We do these things, and it occupies our mind. And back to Channing, he's saying, discipline your mind so that stuff doesn't get in.
But on a deeper level of how we have to do this spiritual work, I think, and why this spiritual work is difficult. Now, I'm sure many of you know that the 1984, the Orwell movie and book and story, and also Huxley and A Brave New World and their stories. Well, I read a quote that kind of talked about Orwell's take on the direction of our society and Huxley's take on the direction of our society. And what's interesting is both of them talk about intrusiveness, but they're very, very different. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban books, for there would be no one who would want to read books. Orwell feared that we would be deprived of information. Huxley feared that they would give us so much information it would reduce us to a passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the, and I wasn't sure what he meant. Remember, this was written in 1940, it's written a while ago, feelies, orgy porgies, kind of thing. So I substituted reality TV, celebrity culture. As Huxley remarked in A Brave New World Revisited, the civil libertarians and the rationalists who were ever on alert to oppose tyranny failed to take into account man's infinite appetite for distractions. Huxley added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In A Brave New World, they were controlled by inflicting pleasure. When you step back and you think about those things, they come in at a deeper level than the surface media, than our arguments with the family of origin minds and our mind. They come in at the level of at this level. I can remember having a counseling office in a Baptist church, and what I noticed with some of the women in this Baptist church is that they knew that they could never preach because women were never called to preach. So a lot of times we look at intrusiveness and words given to people and aggressiveness. Sometimes it's the absence. So here's this little 10-year-old girl watching somebody preach, feeling the movement. Ah, I'd like to do that one day. But there's no place in her culture for that feeling, I'd like to do that one day, to be caught by the community and say, yeah, that would be a good thing. Let your spirit move in that direction. Can that direction be nurtured? There's no place for that idea to be caught. It has no meaning. Therefore, it comes and it goes and it's gone. So sometimes it's an intrusive, but sometimes it's an absence. And sometimes, oddly enough, absence are intrusive. So what do we do today? I'm going to suggest that idea about salvation, and I think there's something to that. Liberty, freedom, from. But another thing, when we think of our seven principles, I know in my mind, and if you're in academia long enough, you make lists for memorization, and That's how we remember things, and we make lists of what we were going to do today and and those kind of things. And when I try to look at the seven principles, they come in a list. And in Western civilization, you read some pastoral counselor thinker types, and they'll say that we worship left brain functioning, linear sequential functioning, and that's what we value in our culture. And when we come from this spiritual position, that at the center of who we are as human beings is the divine image, is the sense of being good, is the ebb and flow of creative energy. That's who we are at the center of who we are, or just this energy that wants to know, that wants to live, that wants to enjoy. There's a goodness at the center of who we are. And those things that I read from Orwell and Huxley, those are things that would callous our inner world so that we no longer know that part of ourselves that's good, that's divine, that's light, that's energy, that part of ourselves would be cut off, would get surrounded. That we think about our seven principles in a different way. We think about our seven principles in a circular fashion, in a way that they're protective for us. And so that when we stand in the middle and we really get a sense for who we are, that we have the first principle that kind of goes around us, and the second principle that kind of goes around, and the third and fourth and fifth, that these principles surround us. For indeed, as we move through life, we are surrounded by air, by water, by one another. We aren't this linear progressive process. And the way we think in this linear progressive process really doesn't match how we exist and how we breathe. We are surrounded. And when somebody says we're surrounded by love, we are surrounded by care, that's closer to who we are. So when we think about the seven principles this week, think about that. And not only do we want to understand the nature of liberty, freedom, salvation, however we want to talk about that, but what does that mean for us as Unitarian Universalists? I'm going to say what those principles do, and other principles, they protect the pathway for us to know our inner selves. They protect the pathway for us to come into contact with that beloved voice that is within ourselves. They protect the pathway for us to get in touch with that light that is within ourselves. And that is the responsibility of us as a people, is to keep those pathways open, is to point to the pathways, is to be on that path ourselves. That is our responsibility as a religious community, not to close that pathway, not to say this is the only pathway, but to bring a light to that path. And when we live in a culture that would close us in, either as Huxley says, by pleasure or the inertia of material, so truth becomes irrelevant, or what Orwell says is that there'll be a total collapse on the mind and you only be one particular way because if you're not, you'll be punished. When I look at our culture, I'm going, we dance between those two poles. But our responsibility is to say no to that. Is to say that we do have that light within us, and you do have that light within you. And when the heart absorbs the mind, we know it in its fullest. So we stay on that path, and we put a light on that path so that others can see it as well, and that's who we are as a community. We claim our heritage from chanting on. One day we will absorb our minds into our hearts, and we will know that love. What a good day that will be.